Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming along. My name is Christopher Coker. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department, and I'm also a co-director of the institute that is hosting this conference, Ideas. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight as one of several book launches that we have planned for the Lent term. I will mention some of those at the very end of the proceedings this evening. We will have a 45-minute talk or so, and then we'll have question and answers. And the books will be available for purchase outside in the corridor after the talk. And there'll be book signing as well if you'd like the author to sign your copy. Now, TV Paul is well known in my area of international relations, indeed outside it. It's James McGill, Professor of International Relations at McGill University. He was president of the ISA a couple of years ago. He's a fellow of the Royal Society in Canada. And he is the author of a very large number of books. And what's very impressive is they're on many, many different subjects, from globalization to nuclear policy, Pakistan, India. And today, a very ambitious book, Restraining Great Powers, Soft Balancing from Empires to the Global Order. Can I just say one other thing before I sit down and ask our speaker to speak? And that is, you should have received an audience evaluation form as you came in. Will you please make sure that you complete those and hand them in on the way back? If I don't tell you that now, I will forget to do so. So, without any further ado, TV, please come up.
Thank you so much. Good evening. It's really impressive that so many people are here on a rainy evening, and I'm honored to be with Professor Coker. We had a similar or a smaller version of a seminar maybe 10 years ago when I was just passing through London, and we both have a common student who was my MS student who did his PhD, now is in South Africa, so it's one way to know that we have the connection. This is a book I've been working for a while, and some of you may be familiar with this International Security, the MIT Press journal, that had three articles some years ago, 2005. It was a kind of a special issue where Steve Walt, myself, and Bob Pape making this case for soft balancing, and some critical analysis from others, including Bill Wolforth and others. And that was not responded. The criticisms were not responded properly, which prompted me to look back at history, diplomatic history, and came to this book, basically. And I came to the conclusion that there's a lot more to self-balancing over the last 200 years of especially great power behavior. So my starting point in this book is, as you will notice, is the great power violence. Great powers are the most violent actors, whether we like it or not. During the 20th century, wars have been the number one killer, other than natural causes. And Cal Hosty has this great figure showing that it is indeed the direct wars and the proxy wars great powers fought and helped to propagate, propel in regions that produced so much casualties. And I am standing in a country that was a big participant or victim to some extent, but clearly it was involved in some of these. And the proxy wars seem to be still going on, great power induced. And this tendency to fight big wars, and of course, must have come down, but the point is, they are preparing for the next big one, and we hopefully not result in that in the coming years. Yet our understanding of great power war, great power conflict, is rather limited. We take it for granted that great powers know the best, and that they have a special God-given responsibility and capacity to maintain order, even though they have a proclivity to cause extraordinary violence to themselves and to others. So the point is, we have big hospitals, big medical research programs to prevent and cure diseases, but we have little by way of preventing wars, as we other than some of the realpolitik approaches. Great powers manage to keep, and of course some institutional approaches, but I'll talk about in a minute. Great powers manage to keep this aura and legitimacy, and there is a lot of institutional power attached to that great power status. The question today is, will great power conflicts recur? And we have the rise of China and resurgence of Russia to some extent. There is aggressive behavior in the Pacific and Ukraine. And in the second decade of 21st century, there is great fear that the Thucydides trap, the book that probably you heard before, is probably going to happen. Well, the question is, can you prevent that? Power transition theories and a whole host of theories, power cycle theories, predict wars. And the problem is, it doesn't have to be big war, but it could be a lot of series of limited war, series of conflicts and crises. And rivalries often produce crises. Now, the general assumption is that great powers are restrained today through their possession of nuclear weapons. And of course, mutual deterrence has created this sort of condition whereby the nuclear revolution, in a sense, is giving us this hope that there will be no war. That itself is under challenge today, as deterrence is being threatened by certain kind of arms race, new arms buildup in particular. The arrival of intensified globalization and the attendant economic interdependence since the 1990s have generated much hope for peaceful transformation. The question is whether this is going to work in the long run or not. Traditional realist approaches to peace or stability among great powers talk about balance of power, then there is deterrence, then there is containment. And balance of power has been the bedrock of international politics and the realist international relations theory. And so security policies of most states, especially the great power states, at least consider this as their primary strategy for maintaining peace and order. And the balance of power has a long pedigree, long historical pedigree, as many civilizations also talk about this. But the European balance of power politics and discourse has had its most profound effect on realist perspective in international politics. And so the premises of balance of power, I'm sure the students especially sitting here already know this, which is the international system is anarchic, no central governing authority, states seek to survive as independent entities, power competition is a fact of life. When a state attempts to become dominant, affected states will form defensive coalitions and or acquire capability to countervail the power. And they create an equilibrium, and that equilibrium is necessary to maintain peace and order. The fundamental goal of balance of power is to maintain the survival and sovereign independence of the state pursuing this particular strategy. So maintenance of status quo is very important. Now, scholars disagree whether it is a conscious strategy or is it a law of politics. One, the distinction between the automatic balance of power and manual balancing, this has been debated in the field. And that's Britain's role as a balancer is another issue, which is essentially whether we talk about continental balancing or offshore balancing, etc. Now, the concept that balance of power scholars often talk about it is what you call hard balancing. Hard balancing relying on two techniques, internal balancing through arms buildup and external balancing through alignments. And alignments are very important in the balance of power game. Now, the puzzle is why you haven't had a big balance of power process since the end of the Cold War. The United States became the unipolar or number one power at the end of the Cold War, yet for at least two decades, you don't see a balancing power coalition emerging against the United States. And that is the puzzle here. And so there's a number of reasons that scholars have attributed, and I'm going to list some of them. Intensified globalization is definitely one of them. And this has made interdependence, unprecedented level of interdependence, and that economies that are deeply entrenched are reluctant to escalate into rivalries, a military competition. That's one set of argument. The second is the widespread availability of international institutions to engage and constrain each other. There's a hope that these institutions, or a proliferation of institutions, give opportunities for states to engage and to restrain themselves. The third is what you call the norm of territorial integrity against forceful change of borders. These norms grew out of the Cold War era and strengthened by the decolonization process that offer a level of assurance against blatant territorial expansion. And so the other factor that people talk about, or one should consider, technological innovations of warfare that sort of support defense and deterrence as opposed to offense. So weapons that are for offense tend to encourage the sort of cult of offensive as we witnessed in the 20th century first half, and that encouraged some states such as Germany to push for expansion through military means. Finally, the absence of intense nationalism propelled by expansionist ideologies such as fascism, Nazism, Marxism, Leninism, all offer a certain amount of comfort that rising powers may not succumb to the temptation to become highly revisionist as previous rising powers did. And so expansionist ideologies are missing today, and indeed it is interesting to note whether that is going to change. We are, at least for the time being, not seeing their presence. So countries seem to be balancing against threats as opposed to balancing against power. And I argue that countries do a lot of this balancing using diplomatic means and clearly institutional means. So that's where this literature on soft balancing sort of come into play. One of the criticisms of previous works were the definitions were not clear enough, mechanisms were not clear enough. So I'm trying to offer a mechanism, and or several mechanisms here, at least three of them. The definition is restraining the power of a state through international institutions, concerted diplomacy while limited informal ententes and partnerships and economic sanctions. So three mechanisms in order to make aggressive actions less legitimate in the eyes of the world, and hence strategic goals more difficult to obtain. So this is limited, tacit, and indirect balancing, and largely through coalition building and diplomatic bargaining at international institutions, short of formal bilateral, multilateral military alliances. So the idea is to form diplomatic coalitions in order to balance a powerful state, especially a threatening state. So the United Nations is the key arena for second-tier great powers to delegitimize, or not to provide the legitimacy for interventions, especially by the United States. I have sort of devised another category of balancing that many states are pursuing today, they call limited hard balancing. This is where states engage in asymmetrical arms buildup and semi-formal alliances such as strategic partnerships. So the relationship between Russia and China today, for instance, or between the United States and India, bit part of this limited strategic, limited hard balancing. They are not alliances like NATO, where there is no agreement of joining in a war, or all the threats that each party faces. There is the understanding that they do support each other in many of their goals, but not all of them. There are a number of other strategies that states are pursuing today: backpassing, binding, bandwagoning, non-alignment to some extent, and of course strategic autonomy as another, and some people call hiding and transcending, as Paul Schroeder talks about in some of his historical works, seem to be still working, but not as much as we witnessed in past historical eras. Institutions are the key mechanism of self-balancing. And throughout the post-Cold War period, you find institutional mechanism being used by countries, often with the idea of restraining, discouraging states from certain behavior. The thing about institutional literature, as many of you are familiar with, there is a lot of focus on functional roles of institutions, such as cooperation, facilitating cooperation, coordination, and liberals in particular talk about facilitating transactions, reducing transaction costs, acting as vehicles of transnational participation, helping to overcome collective action problems, etc. They also help overcome cooperating dilemmas. But realists in general reject institutions as epiphenomena of power. And this is the where the contribution, as far as I'm concerned here, is none of these discussions look at how great powers use institutions or non-great power states benefit from them to reduce the aggressive behavior of great powers. Further, we do not know when and how institutions can generate intense nationalism and confrontational policies in the targeted great power. This remains a weakness of the liberal theories of institutions. So my effort is to understand how great powers use international institutions to balance each other's power or restraining aggressive behavior. This does not mean that other mechanisms don't exist or institutions don't have other purposes. Clearly, institutions have a lot of purposes, and one of them is where great powers and non-great powers attempt to restrain each other. So, the IR literature has not given enough focus on this aspect of institutions. That's the role of power management, power restriction, etc., restrained, etc. Now, one of the thing about the study is that history gives us a lot of examples of this form of self-balancing, starting with the Congress of Vienna, the Concert of Europe, the League of Nations, Japan and Italy in particular were targets of league-induced sanctions. And then you go on to the Cold War period. You had a little bit of activity by the European states to some extent, but not as much as one would like to see. The non-aligned countries. This is actually one of my perhaps theoretical contribution, is theorizing non-alignment as a self-balancing mechanism. Post-Cold War is where most of the activities take place. Kosovo intervention, Iraq. Then the behavior of ASEAN countries. I don't include, at least in this slide, the behavior of Japan and India, for instance. Quite a bit of Central Asian states today. We have Russia and China forming a limited alliance, but not necessarily a hard balancing alliance. All these efforts have one thing in common: denial of legitimacy to the threatening great power. Great powers use institutions to legitimate their power or delegitimize the power and threatening policies of their opponents. And so sometimes this has been practiced, and the idea that durable status as great power is based on legitimacy accorded by the international system. So I use a little bit of the English school as well as constructivist definitions of legitimacy as a tacit acceptance of social structure in which power is exercised, or lawfulness by virtue of being authorized or in accordance with law. So gaining legitimacy through institutions is part of a great power's efforts to gain acceptance by others for its behavior. One of the things that people often forget is that great powers need this legitimacy, even though sometimes they do break that particular role. But clearly it is becoming very important for a durable power to exist, as especially in the hegemonic realm. Now, the post-Cold War cases are quite interesting. The United States intervention in Kosovo, as well as Iraq generated a considerable amount of self-balancing. Kosovo, it was Russia and China. Whereas Iraq, it was a coalition that included also Germany and France. Today, this rise of China is happening, and clearly there hasn't been a major balancing activity against this country. And India is also kind of hedging and engaging in limited hard balancing, to some extent self-balancing with the U.S. and Japan and other countries in Asia-Pacific, at the same time engaging China. Russia is engaging in limited hard balancing and self-balancing, both as an initiator and as a target of Western powers, especially since the Ukraine crisis began. U.S. is the most important case here, and the United States is clearly the target of self-balancing, and 2003 case is very important here. And so, United States initiated a war after trying very hard to get the UN Security Council approval, and this war caused considerable damage to its reputation. And clearly this is one of the reasons why President Obama, in his electoral campaign, made this as a point that the U.S. will withdraw in order to restore its credibility and its reputation. And so I kind of argue that that is a success, if you want to argue, at least limited success, a self-balancing effort by other states. So what we have witnessed is that the formation of limited diplomatic coalitions or ententes, the implicit threat of upgrading alliance relationship if the U.S. goes beyond, has been one of the reasons why there has, one of the strategies that other powers such as China and Russia have engaged in. Why is self-balancing attractive? And self-balancing is attractive partly because the U.S. power position and military behavior are growing concern, but not yet posing a serious challenge to the sovereign existence of other great powers. The dominant state has major source of, offers major source of public goods in both the economic and security arenas, which cannot easily be replaced. The dominant state could not easily retaliate, as the balancing efforts by others are not overt or directly challenging its power position with military means. And so self-balancing offers an opportunity for states to engage the dominant power and develop institutional links with it. So second-tier states have engaged in what you call strategies to make sure the American interventions did not get the collective legitimation of the United Nations. And the success of U.S. interventions depends on post-intervention peacekeeping and stabilization support by the UN members. And the U.S. did find it very hard to maintain its position in Iraq without this support. So the effort has been to make the U.S. hegemony rule-bound. The U.S. definitely ignored this in the intervention by George Bush and his administration, but clearly it is an example of attempts by states to restrain without a hard-balancing coalition. The rise of China has clearly starting, and today in particular, considerable concern among many states that this will generate a round of conflict. And what is interesting is it has not generated the automatic hard balancing, especially among Asia-Pacific states, other than, of course, the pre-existing alliances with Japan and the United States. And what you find is China has managed to acquire quite a bit of position power. And of course, its expansion to South China Sea is happening in the context of this expansion. Yet, it is yet to face an intense balance of power coalition. Balancing against threats matter more than power in the contemporary era. And this is what we need to look at, the dynamic nature of balance of power, as an important part of our discussion. Russia, the same way, of course, Ukraine adventure has generated quite a bit of limited hard balancing and soft balancing, so it's a mixture of cases. Now, what are the ideal conditions for soft balancing to work? The threat environment has to be low. And one thing that we often forget is the first two decades of post-war, big war, or something like the end of the Cold War, are periods when great powers are interested in institutions. There is fatigue among great powers and their allies, and you find that the golden era of institutions are the first two decades or three decades. Institutions decline. Institutions need human agency. One of the mistakes of institutional literature, I mean, Cohen's famous book, After Hegemony, it assumes that institutions just live on. Yes, institutions live on, but they do need our support, human support. Same, by the way, for democracy, democratic institutions. So leaving these institutions to some kind of other forces is not sufficient. They need leadership. They need support. Sometimes that doesn't happen because great powers start losing their interest in institutions to a great extent. The second favorable condition is international order give powers opportunity to make substantial economic progress without Congress. If there is one thing that you can talk about a peaceful power transition is the great opportunity the globalization has given to rising powers such as China and India to become economically rich. Doesn't mean all the Chinese and the Indians are becoming rich. But the fact of the matter is that this is there are not many examples of this kind of a rise without conflict, because these countries have become beneficiaries of globalization. So if there is one thing the United States did well, is to have this globalization process without much disruption, and then these countries have benefited. But today that may be leading to other consequences that we can talk about, deglobalization and income inequality, etc. The third condition is legitimacy matters to great powers. Legitimate power has its advantages and legitimacy is respected by all. So great powers have to believe that legitimacy of institutions also matter. If they believe institutions are largely developed by opponents to contain their power, they will disregard such institutions. And this is what happened during the 1930s. The Japanese definitely did not accept the arms control, naval arms control regime, as well as the League of Nations as an effort to control them, and then the American sanctions. And so they should see institutions as legitimacy enhancers, give them more legitimacy, and thus the core interest of great powers, especially in the security arena, are not fundamentally affected by international institutional pressures. A fourth condition is what he called nationalism is law among great powers. The absence of an intense expansionist ideology like fascism will also help self-balancing. Finally, military technology and geographic configuration do not allow quick advancement and territorial changes. This book is also an effort to respond to criticisms of self-balancing, and I will list the criticisms and then respond to them one by one. Chief among these criticisms are, there is little empirical support. Second, simple diplomatic friction and not a concerted policy. Three, episodic behavior, hence it lacks consistency. Third, a rhetorical device rather than an active policy instrument. Fourth, not too many cases to make a theoretically strong argument. Fifth, as a policy instrument, success is not guaranteed. And finally, it may have relevance only under conditions of unipolarity, and hence like value of other system, and hence little value for other systems. So how do I respond to those? In the book, I have detailed discussion about each one of these. I argue that soft balancing has considerable empirical support, as the chapters from Concert of Europe onwards, discussion of Concert of Europe onwards, show that this is not a random policy instrument. It is not a day-to-day simple diplomatic friction we are discussing here. As the case study show, great powers use institutions on a consistent basis to restrain the power and aggressive policies of targeted states. Non-great power states also increasingly use these instruments as conscious policy instruments and on a consistent basis. The policy of self-balancing is a rational response and often caused by the difficulties of relying on hard balancing to achieve behavioral change. Fourth, there is no guarantee that hard balancing efforts can create peace. This is one very big myth that especially realists hold, is that balance of power somehow creates peace. We really don't know when balance is achieved, whether we can achieve that on a permanent basis, and there is always a temptation, especially if a revisionist state, among a revisionist state, to break the balance through asymmetrical strategies and asymmetrical weaponry, as Germany and Japan did before World War II to some extent. The implicit assumption is that military balancing tends to work more effectively, or states favor this approach than the other for the lack of more effectiveness. There is little evidence that hard balancing can work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And today states can develop or sidestep balancing by developing asymmetrical strategies as China is doing. And so it is not clear balancing is what is often happening. In fact, if you ask American realists in particular, for balance of power, they are actually talking about is preponderance of American power. Okay, it's not equilibrium they're talking about. It's American power should be dominant, especially in the Pacific, to maintain peace. That is not balance of power. That is basically preponderance, as Gilpin talks about in his hegemonic stability sort of argument. And so, many great power wars in the European era are blamed for balance of power policies. And so clearly that it is a contested idea. It, of course, is needed. I'm not saying that it is not something states can afford to forget about it. But the point is, we need to be careful that the idea that it generates peace all the time is questionable. The unipolar era, of course, saw more self-balancing, but it happened under all systems, and it is not purely based on the system or structure of the system. Soft law and soft power both are valuable components of international politics today. It's a mistake to discount softer approaches to world politics. In international law, a powerful branch is called soft law. And it has been argued that soft law is preferred because of concerns of sovereignty. They are more effective to deal with uncertainty, facilitate compromise for actors with different time horizons, discount rates and degrees of power. Soft balancing serves some of these purposes when flexibility is called for. It can also avoid the entrapment problem inherent in hard alliances or hard balancing alliances. Similarly, soft power, relying on culture and other attractive power, is valuable for countries in their comprehensive national power. Now, IR scholars have accepted the existence of both soft law and soft power, although questions of measurement and impact are often expressed. Similarly, there is nothing wrong in arguing that softer approaches to balance of power, balancing power or threatening behavior cannot be included in our discussion about power balancing. And so my effort in the book is to advance the debate of on balance of power and also to show the dynamic nature of balance of power as an evolving concept. The world is much more complex today than when the balance of power theory was developed in the European context over the past 300 years. It's a mistake to stick with the narrow approach to balancing, relying on military instruments alone, without exploring larger processes. Progression is a purpose here, even when one realizes that richness is also a virtue, along with parsimony and rigor. The purpose is to offer more clarity to the scope conditions under which both hard and soft balancing occurs, measurements and defining outcomes. Further, as we now have multiple cases from the past and the present, evaluation has become much easier. soft-balancing art's richness and broadens the understanding of balance of power. It's a great tool for doing nothing versus armed response. It adds flexibility as countries can still engage the target states. So, the point though, that it doesn't always generate peace. That's one thing that I show, that soft balancing can also generate considerable conflict, as again the Japanese and the Italian cases come into the picture. Skeptics who deride institutional means of restraining power often argue that institutions do not bring any lasting peace. John Mearsheimer, I believe he is visiting London pretty soon, for instance, contends that institutions have minimal impact on world politics. They reflect the preferences of powerful actors, and their creation and maintenance depends on their interests. Cooperation difficult to maintain. These criticisms of institutions reflect an apolitical understanding of the value of institutions. If they are worthless enterprises, why do great powers participate in a plethora of institutions and sometimes allow themselves to be followers of international institutional norms? The perspective also ignores classical realist attention to diplomacy, international law, and legitimacy of power. If institutions have no value in balancing, the same logic can be applied to balancing through weaponry and alliances. These are also fleeting if they work at all. Institutions matter to great powers even when they declare they don't. They go to these institutions to gain legitimacy. The U.S. indeed spent some 3 to 6 months in different cases to gain the support of the Security Council. Before intervention, of course, it broke those institutional restraints, but clearly it tried. Even today, we hear about the Trump administration abandoning institutions, but this can be discussed. Obviously, still the U.S. goes to these institutions for balancing or soft-balancing purposes. So, the emerging international order, sort of coming to a conclusion here, what we are witnessing is institutions gained quite a bit of importance, but slowly they may be suffering some amount of fatigue, and countries are starting to think about different approaches. Nationalism is starting to emerge in a different manifestation. Resurging Russia is trying to engage in more military activism. But despite all this, what you're witnessing is not the intense balancing, but limited hard balancing, perhaps the next step toward from soft to limited to probably hard balancing. But one thing is very clear, that the great powers cannot, especially rising powers, cannot abandon institutions. And if they abandon, that will not be in their interest. So that is why even China, they're developing their own institutions. And this, if you look at the behavior of these states, and smaller states in particular, for an institution, especially in the ASEAN region, as one way to restrain the great power rivalries from emerging in their regions. So, the threat environment is changing, a complex system, but I would argue that you need flexible strategies. Cannot put all your eggs in one basket, and that is very clear in the behavior of states all over the world today. They are not following one path, but a mixture of strategies. Now, this is definitely the challenge. The picture captures the challenge. And that is populism, nativism, dangers of deglobalization, and the pitfalls of abandoning institutions. But one can argue that U.S. leadership will depend heavily on institutional power that it has. This is where I agree with the liberals, that it has accrued over a period of time. And that a peaceful transition can occur only if you have institutional base to power. And the rising powers are indeed beneficiaries of a peaceful change if the institutions persist or they develop new institutions. So, international order in the 21st century, big question mark still, but clearly there is a lot more than simple hard balancing strategies, and we need to think about multiple strategies to deal with multiple situations. So the book is quite a bit of theory, but at the same time, a lot of historical case studies. And each one of these case studies show that institutional balancing mattered considerably to great powers and non-great powers over the past 200 years. I guess I'll stop there, and then we can have a conversation and questions from the audience.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We're going to take the questions seated. So if you wouldn't mind standing up when you pose your question and identifying yourself at the same time, your institutional affiliation. Can I just ask you just on a minor point? Why didn't you call it smart balancing? Hillary Clinton's idea of a smart power is both hard and soft at the same time. Did you ever think of calling it smart balancing or dismiss that from the outset?
Yeah, some scholars and some policymakers think that there is a similar concept that can be developed. But what I noticed is that this balancing is often not smart. Soft balancing need not produce the kind of outcome that smart balancing. Smart balancing is a mixture of hard and soft, and perhaps asymmetrical means, different means to achieve your goals. The problem is there is no real exact formula here. And soft balancing is sometimes preferred because there's nothing else you can do other than going through institutions. Smart balancing assumes that you have instruments, and sometimes states, big powers may have, but you find that it's not that easy to organize this in such a way to call it smart balancing. But there is room for theoretical innovation, clearly, in that context.
By the way, John Mearsheimer will be here tomorrow.
Oh, good.
Talking about Godzilla, as he refers to China, and various other things. So it's very interesting you're here today. Some people in the audience will be there tomorrow as well. Anyway, let's open it up to questions. So, yes.
Shall
I
stand up?
Please.
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm a public policy student at UCL. You started to touch on it towards the end of your presentation, and I'm kind of asking what happens when the institutions that kind of represent all countries on a multilateral basis are overwhelmingly filled with European and North American kind of leaders. So would this soft balancing theory expectancy rival institutions to the World Trade Organization and the IMF, which might be more favorably weighted in favor of global southern countries?
Yeah, well, that's interesting that the IMF and the Bretton Woods system created institutions are dominated by North American as well as European countries. But what you notice is that the Global South, or China in particular, have taken initiatives to create their own institutions. The BRICS Development Bank, New Development Bank, the Infrastructure Bank, all these suggest that this is one way to counter. I don't call that balancing. It's probably economic balancing, but it's another thing. But one thing is very clear, that institutions such as the United Nations Security Council, the security institutions, are not functioning all that well, partly because of the inability of the great powers, the P5, to develop a strategy to acquire and give legitimacy and face the issues that the world is facing. You notice that the General Assembly seems to be a little bit more active than used to be. And we have institution called Group of 20, G20, which, by the way, has more potential than most other institutions today. And people argue that perhaps it's not the Security Council. We have to think of G20 as a crisis management mechanism, which has not happened yet, but this potential exists because the Security Council is not going to be expanded anytime soon, given the way the power was structured in 1945. So the question is whether powerful states will give a role to these rising powers. China has acquired quite a bit of power, and it's already a P5, and it is also engaging other countries, BRICS, for instance, G20, SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There is a series of organizations associated with the ASEAN countries. So it's not clear these countries have to go to these systems that were created after post-World War II. They have other means to deal with their issues. There's a lot of one-on-one diplomatic engagements also going on. And so I think it will be useful to give these non-European states a role, but maybe they are going to create their own institutions if they really want more say in the way the world is structured.
Robert.
Let me just wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Robert from the LSE. So in the beginning of your presentation, you made the point that since the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, there hasn't been a rebalancing of power. Kind of going off the last question, we look at China's advancement with One Belt and One Road to be a rebalancing of power against American hegemony. And if not, why is that the case?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating case. It's a mixture of expansion, if some people call it a new East India Company model, basically. Expansion without generating the kind of intense hostility. But the problem is, it hasn't really provided China yet the kind of dominance in the Asia-Pacific region. It has the potential, and it also has the potential for a peaceful transition, if it succeeds. Because Chinese strategy is quite fascinating. We haven't yet understood that quite well. And if you look at the One Belt, and that is part of the grand strategy of expansion without generating intense conflict as in happened in the past. But the problem is that this strategy could fail because many of the places where China is engaging or developing infrastructure, providing, creating extraordinary domestic conflicts, domestic opposition, as already Maldives, I don't know if you follow these cases, Sri Lanka, where there's a lot of opposition, because the Chinese infrastructure money does not come free. It's 8% interest rate. And most of these countries don't have the capacity to pay back. So what if they don't pay back? China may ask for real estate, and that's where the East India Company comparison comes in. And the point is that may generate more opposition, but if China is very careful, it may achieve a kind of dominance in the entire region without really firing any bullet. And so there is both merit and drawback from a Chinese point of view, but over time, how it will go and how other countries will react. Already India and Japan and the United States also have thought of some way of, corridors they're talking about, although they're not very active yet. But I think they expect it to fail. Now, European countries also talk about it. And therefore, it is better China bleeds itself rather than these countries go and waste their energy. I was in Sri Lanka last year and asking to some of the people there. They also think that this is a very risky strategy for small countries plus China. But China is everywhere, by the way, in Sri Lanka today, which shows that it can potentially have a bigger say in the way the regional order is structured. So this strategy, I think, has got both positives and negatives, and China may show that it can achieve its goals without a big balance of power competition, if it succeeds.
Hey, I'm Jorge, studying international history here at LSE. These are like two questions, but very related. Kissinger said that the European consort was successful because the European powers share some common values and have like the same concept of legitimacy. Do you think that there is that the soft balancing requires like a common frame of values? And do you think also that like the post-Cold War order was built upon a sort of liberal consensus that is now weakened?
Yeah, there's a lot of agreement that the five powers that devised the concert system had quite a bit of commonalities. But that did not last long. The Crimean War happens and then they fight later on too. So it shows that any arrangement, institutional or balance of power arrangements, don't last forever. They do go through major changes. And common values don't exist either after a period of time because the domestic arrangements change, regimes change, their ideas change. And the desire for, of course, dominance is one big problem, especially in the European system as we find in historical periods. So the post-Cold War period create certain common values, especially in the post 9/11 period, but that is slowly disappearing, unfortunately, partly because both China and Russia have different visions of international order, and the United States is also changing its vision of international order, abandoning to some extent the liberal order. And this is the most risky thing the U.S. may lead to, because the liberal order gave it legitimacy. The liberal order gave it alliances. It gave it a lot of strength to the American hegemony and durability. Once it removed that liberal aspect of it, then it becomes another greedy great power. Nothing much there to look for. But my sense is the American public is a lot more... they can change their opinion, and the current order, the disorder you find may change, maybe not the next election, but the following election. So the cyclical nature of American domestic policy, you also had George Bush and other leaders who engage in a certain kind of behavior. So my hope is in the American public that has certain capacity to reinvigorate. And they also want global leadership, even if the current situation is not beneficial. I think the challenge is going to come from China and Russia. Both have domestic regimes that do not really share the same value, Western values. And they want status, higher position in the international order based on certain attributes that they have. And so the question is whether the Western countries, the liberal order, can accommodate them, give them an opportunity to exist together and prosper together. And that's a big question mark, whether 21st century that will happen. China in particular, its strategy of this sort of tributary model it is pursuing under Xi Jinping in particular, one can see that this can generate some level of tensions in the international order. But China has been so far reasonably successful. First of all, China has not engaged in intense hard balancing through military weapon systems or alignments. It's not able to get the alliances it is probably looking for. But China is resorting to what you call asymmetrical strategies, and as well as economic strategies, the BRI in particular. These are its efforts to transcend the so-called potential for great power rivalry. So how the U.S. will react over a period of time, that's a question mark. Shared values through institutional means are important, but you need common threats. And common threats seem to be changing at this point in time.
Yeah, I've got a question over here.
I would like to know your opinion.
You just say who you are.
I'm a diplomat. I would like to know your opinion about the use of currency as a tool to restrain great powers.
You are basically referring to economic statecraft. Economic statecraft could include currency manipulations, a whole host of approaches. I don't think these are permanent or, you know, consistent strategy, because currencies can be manipulated, and the next day something else can happen. Because of the short period involved in it, they are not very proper instruments. But institutional mechanisms and sanctions in general have a lot of value as soft balancing, as we're witnessing. You need a period of time for any kind of strategy to work. Currency manipulation is not one of them. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Hi, Carl, from here in the LSE. Just on the currency thing, actually, sort of related to it, and the petrodollar seems to be in decline. Like, there seems to be a bit of kind of pushback on that between Iran and Russia, and also I think even between India and China lately. They did some transactions outside of the petrodollar, which would have been unthinkable maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Is there a change in policy on the U.S. side, or is it just a reflection of reduced hegemony, or have they just not been provoked enough in order to generate a reaction?
There's a lot of talk of a replacing dollar as by these rising powers. I don't see that's happening anytime soon. Even petrodollar is not a mechanism that there's a lot of currency swapping, and you know, Iran buying taking Indian currency, for instance, instead of dollar. But dollar is still dominant, as you know, that it has certain levers, certain power. The Chinese currency has not acquired the same strength. It can happen, and that may require a collapse of American economy and the confidence in the U.S. economic system. I don't think that's anytime soon, because the U.S. still has a lot of power, and the hegemony is there. And I don't see any of these instruments generating sufficient power yet. But in the long run, yes. Well, the pound was once upon a time the king of all the currencies. Then the dollar took over. So it has potential, but whether the countries have the desire to give the Chinese currency this lead role yet is yet to be seen. But there could be a condition where 50-60% of global economic wealth could concentrate in Asia-Pacific, such as China and India, as happened in 200 years ago, 300 years ago. And if that happens, then the question is whether their currencies will have a bigger role to play. So currency is connected to hegemony, but I don't see it cannot be just divorced from that particular pattern of rise and decline of states, especially great powers. And so the United States still retains the position, and there is a tendency to engage in limited transactions like what you discussed, but I don't see that as a major challenge to American dominance yet.
Last question.
Hi, my name is Josh. I'm an environmental policy consultant. You've touched a bit about China, so I particularly wanted to ask you about the asymmetry word that you've been using, because for all that I can see, being an economic student, China is doing the same thing that the U.S. did after the Second World War, and that Great Britain's done in different times in history. So how is this kind of new asymmetry that you're saying China's doing any different from what other great powers have done throughout history? Thank you.
Yeah, China is not creating the institutional setup as effectively as the United States did after World War II. China is not opening its market, but the U.S. did open its market. So if you go to Gilpin's idea or others' idea of hegemonic stability, United States at least opened its market to its allies, considerable economic rebuilding, Marshall Plan onwards. One of the mistakes that China is doing today, if I may argue that, is to acquire wealth as fast as it can, but not giving the opportunity to its trading partners. There are reasons for that. China is a cheaper manufacturer and these countries benefit. But if China wants to acquire hegemony, acquire leadership, it will have to open up as the United States did. So there is that difference to some extent. The other big difference is, you look at the weapons acquisitions of China. It seems building a lot of these capabilities that are not equal to what the United States is doing. It's not building the aircraft carriers as fast or as big as the United States is doing. It is doing stuff like anti-submarine, anti-satellite, and quite a bit of new technologies to asymmetrically face the American power. United States massively built its capabilities, nuclear weapons included. China is not building as much as we know. But it is increasing defense spending, by the way. And that is the interesting part, whether at some point it will have an equal defense spending as the United States. So the other big thing is Chinese intervention strategies. United States had this tendency to intervene, sometimes, by the way, unnecessarily, and generating a lot of bloodshed. China is not intervening as it is. It is engaging in what you call wedge strategy. And there are two dimensions. One is the wedge strategy among states. The ASEAN states are being, they're trying to create a wedge. The other one is wedge strategy within countries such as New Zealand, Australia, and I'm sure many European states. this strategy is to create pro-China, anti-China forces within. And this may or may not succeed. And you don't find that kind of intense strategy by the United States. Of course, it intervened in some countries. But its focus was on, after 1949, the Soviet Union and that threat. So there was creation of intense hard balancing coalition, military buildup, strategies, and mutual assured destruction. So all this show that China is perhaps playing this game quite differently. Now the question is whether it can claim hegemony or the kind of global leadership based on these parameters, or it will rely a lot on economic parameters, especially through the BRI. So a lot of that is up in the air, and whether the United States would decline, which is another big question mark. The U.S. does not decline as fast as we think. It may take some more years. But one thing is very clear. If China, even if it maintains a 5% growth rate, will become number one economy at some point in the next 20, 30 years. And India may be second or third. So what do we do at that point in time? And the question mark is whether hegemony will be bifurcated or truncated, and whether the U.S. will have to accommodate, and whether we can get a peaceful accommodation. This is a question that IR, international relations scholars, have not properly addressed. So we have peaceful change in literature in the past, E.H. Carr to Gilpin to others, but there is a dearth of a good scholarship on when do we get peaceful change, when do we get violent change. So Mearsheimer will say tomorrow that war is inevitable, or we're going to enter into this realm. It's almost like saying death is inevitable, isn't it? Or you're going to get a heart attack. So don't we have to do something about prolonging that death process? I mean, or making it a better world? You know. So that's where this so-called structural realism fails to offer some strategies other than hard balancing and other forms of military alignments, etc. And I also think that leaving it to destiny is a big problem, and realism has this destiny attached to it. It is bound to happen, therefore, what? Yes, balancing is one. I don't discount that hard balancing is necessary. Sometimes it is. Deterrence is necessary. Containment is necessary. But we also need to look at softer instruments if you want to get peaceful transition, and how to integrate, how to accommodate rising powers in particular.
Okay. One behind.
Hi, Martin Payne from LSE Ideas. I was pleased to see your sort of thinking around technology and how that constrains some of the hard power approaches. My particular interest is cyber, where it seems to me some of the emerging capabilities are, they create scope for deniable or even covert activity, and there are loose international norms, if any. So I was really curious as to where you felt that might fit into your thinking.
Yes, cyber is very much up in the air, whether it is an offense-connected capability or defense. I mean, it can be both, no? To some extent, you can have an offensive power. One of the great things about cyber is that it is so spread out that no power has a monopoly of even a smaller states can develop certain capabilities if it wants. So there is a kind of equilibrium there already, but technology is so rapidly changing, we don't know, especially artificial intelligence connected to that. And so that is why this notion that nuclear revolution is here to stay is questionable. There are people who believe that the new technologies may outstrip the whole nuclear revolution. There may be something else that we will start looking at as the weapon of mass destruction or deterrence. So cyber is one area, a definitely emerging area. Artificial intelligence is potentially another one, which especially relating to the kind of warfare that they are talking about. So the question is, who will gain major access to that, major control over that? That may also generate either deterrence or offense dominance to some extent. But my sense is that countries are a lot faster these days to develop defense capacities, even in the cyber context, that we may not get the kind of 1920s, 1930s situation. But you are absolutely right. We need norms and a kind of regime to control this. There is an outer space treaty, but that is not that effective anymore. It seems this is the time to think about restraining the spread of or use of cyber as a weapon. And there is a common interest here, but leadership is missing, as we can see. Nobody has really pushed forward this idea of a cyber weapons regime, a regime that will restrain or come up with some norms that is good for everybody concerned.
In fact, there is a new arms race now. It's artificial intelligence between the US and China.
Artificial intelligence is fast emerging as the big area.
We had Lucas Kellow here last year from Oxford in the cyber program, saying specifically that because it's impossible to have a normative regime in cyberspace, we've been working at it, we haven't got it, we now have an era of what he calls unpeace, neither war nor peace. Your model is of course predicated on the fact that we can distinguish between war and peace. We can have one or we can have the other. He's actually arguing that we're moving into an age in which we have either permanent war or permanent destabilized peace, if you like. And that's of course.
It's an interesting concept, but my problem is, again, the human agency part is very important. I mean, the problem with many of the IR theory and some of these theories that we enter into periods, but if you look at historically, the role of leadership mattered, how the world ended up the way it did, and periods of, and crises generate leadership. We talk about the liberal leadership. The liberals are partly to be blamed for the current predicament, partly because the liberals came up with solutions to collective action problems. At the end of World War II, they had the Great Society idea, they had the welfare state, but the liberals abandoned their role of, the social welfare and Clinton period onwards in the United States. And even today, they don't come up with a strategy to deal with this huge division or this imbalance in wealth and wealth distribution. And that's why I think they are in for shocks, because societies are going through this Karl Polanyi moment of double movement. You know, there's a lot of unhappy people out there. It's not going to end anytime soon, because at least the unhappiness, what is happening in education and other areas, many of you, as some of you are probably from the U.S., you know, it costs about $70,000 to $80,000 to go to a third-year college in the U.S. today, a private college. And education is denied to the lower middle class. How can you create a society without that educational opportunity to these generations to come? So I think there's a lot the liberals can do, but they have given this globalization and economic forces, the Washington consensus, they haven't yet abandoned it. They're still stuck with that. And so the alternative being proposed is the nativist populist ideas are having quite a bit of traction, partly because of liberal failure, at least that's my argument.
Any more questions? Yes, I've got lots of questions. Few over here. Actually, I think, can we take two questions together? So I think there was another one over at the back. Yes, can we start here?
Yes. Are there areas where powers have failed to develop appropriate or useful soft balancing strategies? And I'm really inviting you to comment a bit about India and Pakistan.
Okay. India and Pakistan
Yes. One of them. Give you time to think.
Good question.
I
will have.
I was a student here many, many years ago, but I'm now retired, having worked for many years in the IMF. Just on that, as far as China's concerned, China's actually had a lot of influence in recent years. Its quota's gone up. It's now the third largest, which is its voting rights within the fund. It's now got a deputy managing director along with an American and Japanese under Mrs. Lagarde. And its currency is now one of the five recognized international currencies in the SDR. So that's all happened in the last three or four years. So China's become much more important within the fund. My question really is, how much do you think President Trump is actually a threat to international agencies? I say this because I gave a lecture to UCL students just after Trump was elected and asked this very question. I didn't think it would have too much impact on the IMF. So far, I must admit, I haven't seen the IMF be much different before and after Trump. Now, maybe that's an unusual case. the World Bank president issue will make me interested. Maybe it hits different international agencies differently, but I just wonder whether the concern over the impact may be not as large as what will actually happen. Thank you.
Yeah, but the ambience has changed. No, the kind of the environment since then, you know, we don't talk about the role of great powers building coalitions to create problems, facing problems, etc. I think the question of China's role, if we talk about peaceful transition through institutional accommodation, this is probably a necessary step. But will China be happy with some representation, or does it want leadership dominance in these systems? This is, this is a problem realist, and Mearsheimer is going to say this desire to acquire more and more is there. So how do we prevent that? So the question is whether the existing institutions have the capacity to accommodate these rising powers, especially China. But the good thing is that China is creating its own institutions, as I mentioned a couple of them, and that IMF, World Bank may be two instruments, but there may be other mechanisms for countries to go and acquire debt or resources. So in that sense, this mechanism of institutional integration of a rising power is very important, and the question is how far it can accommodate China's goals. So the ball is in China's court up to a point. How much you want? What's your end game? What's your goal in the international arena? And there are people who worry that the current regime may have a little bit more expansive goal than Deng Xiaoping and the other successors did. Is President Trump a threat? Well, that's an interesting question. My sense is President Trump is restrained by his own military, his own commanders. There's a lot of institutional restraints, even though they may not come out and speak of it. But statements and actions have definitely created considerable dissonance. This may be, again, a passing phenomenon, I think. I don't see another leader of this nature emerging anytime soon in the United States to some extent. But at the same time, the question is if he is going to win some of these trade wars, some of these issues, will the public support increase or not? There's a lot of imponderables here, but clearly his lack of understanding of international order, the role of the U.S. that played, institutional role, etc., have to be of concern to many, and I'm sure you living in Europe feel the concern a lot more. I don't know what to say. President Trump is a challenge to world order, to United States itself, and he is not showing the signs of transformation as many leaders did in the past. So there is a recklessness to his strategy, and some people say that recklessness may produce results. We are yet to see the lot of those results, maybe some, but clearly without other trading partners also growing as markets for American products, where are they going to export these things? So in a sense, there is an interest in, ultimately look at it, other countries also growing and not collapsing, because that will affect the American economic prosperity in the long run. So whether the Americans realize, the electorate realize President Trump's actions or his threats, it's a matter of time. And also the opposition. The opposition is missing. That's part of the challenge. I haven't seen a concerted intellectual challenge to Trumpism yet. It's going to probably take some efforts because the liberals are divided. Nancy Pelosi is coming up with some strategies, but there's a lack of a concerted action and a strategy to deal with this Trump challenge, which is reflected in many other parts of the world today, fast emerging nativism and populism.
And the other question about self-balancing between India and
Pakistan. Oh, India and Pakistan, yes. Unfortunately, it is a story of hard balancing.
Yeah.
And China is a big participant in that. China's it's not formed a military alliance per se, but it is now through the CPEC or China-Pakistan Economic Corridor has brought in a Chinese involvement much more in Pakistan than before. And the potential opening of the port that the Chinese have built for naval purposes, all that generate considerable balancing opportunities for China and Pakistan. But what is interesting is that China has an interest to keep India also as part of its partner. So it doesn't cross certain lines yet. And other than the nuclear area, where China definitely helped Pakistan. And it has not really done too much to upset the relationship with India, as only occasions on Kashmir or other issues. But there are those, I also think that if the CPEC succeeds, it may reduce the potential for conflict in the region. So that's why the Chinese strategy has to be studied in that context also. There is a great economic opportunity for Pakistan, and that a conflict with India will upset all that, and for China too. It is the biggest investment that China has made under BRI today is in the Pakistani, that corridor. So if that corridor has to succeed, it needs a certain amount of peace in the region. So I don't want to call it soft balancing, but it's clearly China is playing different games with Pakistan. But there are limitations to that particular alignment, as we notice. And Pakistan is also constrained by the fact that there is Afghanistan, there is Xinjiang, all these other hotbeds exist. And therefore, it is a story, a dynamic situation there. And China has to be given some credit for coming up with an economic strategy that is different from the Western economic strategy vis-a-vis Pakistan. Now the question is whether Pakistan has the domestic capacity to use this opportunity to build an economy. Big question mark, because Pakistan is not building engineering colleges, unfortunately. And China should help Pakistan engineering colleges, technical institutions, train the Pakistani youth in that area rather than other things. So China is bringing their own labor. And this is a question mark whether Pakistan has the institutional economic infrastructure to make use of this opportunity. If it does, then we may get certain externalities, certain outcomes that may produce some kind of peace, maybe cold peace or whatever, over a period of time. But I won't bet too much. The Pakistani military has its own interests, and that is the big question mark. Where will it place its bets on?
I only got a few 10 minutes or less left. Any more questions over there? There's one over here and one over there. And we'll take them together if we can.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So, well, you've lost the microphone, but you found it.
My name is Phil Millett. I'm not affiliated with university. I'm an engineer by profession, much traveled. Question on the European foreign policy. Does it really function, you think, as a traditional self-interested / advocacy institution function, or as a multilateral institution giving the smaller countries a seat at the big table with the likes of Germany and providing cover for Germany, perhaps?
Okay. There's one over there. Over here.
I'm a student here, and you talked about liberalism giving America its powers, and liberalism giving America its strengths. So my question is, what role public opinion plays in the soft balancing, especially given the rise of China and its role in, or its ambiguous human rights reputation?
Right. One last question. Yeah.
Yeah, just actually, I was just going to ask. I didn't think anyone else had a question, so this is my second question. Sorry. I was just going to ask about since 1990 or 91, the battles that the political ideological battles have gone away, and that was the excuse sometimes for not pushing on globalization, that the overriding, concern was that ideological kind of conflict. So since then, though, it seems to have stagnated. Like, even with the CFR and everything,
there seems to be a lot of, you know, elite politicians across the world seem to want it, but it just doesn't seem to be happening, and there are new institutions are coming up. I mean political globalization as opposed to the private sector.
And can I just add one question of my own, because it actually follows up on this. There may not be any ideological divisions, but there are certainly increasing cultural divisions, and since culture is absolutely central to soft balancing, what we see is that culture is increasingly divisive, with people talking about geocultural birthmarks in the South China Seas, with the Russians talking about privileged civilizational zones of interest, which is why, of course, the split between the Ukrainian and Russian Orthodox churches is so dangerous to them, of course, at the moment. Islamic caliphate, it's very interesting. Here you have an alternative international order, which is based not on a nation state, but on the caliphate coming back into history. So this is a total rejection of the system that one is trying to preserve, in a sense, or at least prevent from collapsing in war. And it's, the last point is, if you're looking at the Great Belt Road Initiative, people forget the cultural aspect of that. The Chinese have identified 500 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, and that is intended to knock Europe off the perch as the number one area for UNESCO World Heritage Sites. So this competition in culture, I think, is definitely growing. There are also other trends, of course. But if you could just say a word or two about that, that would be great.
Oh, what is interesting is the use of culture by certain elite in different countries, in particular in India, for instance. The kind of rhetoric that you see often associated with electoral politics, and it has resonance in the Russians talk about their resurgence. But regimes that try to gain legitimacy using culture or religion or civilization did exist in the past, but it is coming back in a big way, partly because it is useful for these regimes. They don't have much of a liberal strength in that sense. To some extent, the failure of liberalism, and that is connected to these institutions also, is that a historical necessity, or liberalism has in the past faced challenges? You know, even Immanuel Kant talks about there will be challenges, but eventually liberal order will prevail. The problem is liberalism is not penetrating or solving problems as it did in the past. And I think that's where this opportunity for other forms of organizations, and the Chinese in particular, are making every effort to show that liberal failure and their model is more successful. But is their model replicable? This is the big question mark. Whether we like it or not, most people sitting here cannot become Chinese nationals, okay? Whereas you can become a national of the United States if you migrate or through the proper, or Britain for that matter. I think that's the big difference. This unique cultural societies that claim to be propagating their values don't allow others, the non-cultural person, to come in. And if at all liberalism has a strength, is in that, the ability of a non-native person to come and become part of it, and the liberal projects. Liberals have started to, I mean, this is where actually another problem with Trump's policy. Trump puts a lot of walls into immigration, for instance. What does that mean? And indeed, the stoppage of educational opportunities for students from different parts of the world, one of the biggest mistakes. The American power is very much, the soft power in particular, based on these students who come to this country and become part of it and go back in some cases as sort of these big ambassadors for American power. And that is a big mistake. And today, actually, Canada is getting a lot more students because we are opening up a lot more, I guess. And so culture is a good foil in some cases. But the problem is none of these alternative models can replace the liberal order. Not that I'm a big fan of liberals in every sense, but the point is that we have to think about what else, but we need to think of coexistence as well, which is another problem of liberalism. Liberals believe in sanctimony. They don't have an opportunity. Liberal victory is something that is necessary, yes, but at the same time, at what cost? And how do we give an opportunity for China, for instance, if it doesn't become a liberal state, which is most likely to happen? And so the assumption of Clinton period onwards was that somehow if economic opportunity is given to the Chinese, they will demand more democracy and freedom. It's a modernization theory. That hasn't happened. So coexistence as a strategy, as an opportunity to develop institutions where countries of different cultures, societies can participate, that will be very important for even the institutions to succeed in the future. The public opinion is very important part of soft balancing, by the way. I mentioned the case of Iraq war, and then what Obama tried to do was to show that U.S. reputation has suffered. The public agreed with that. And that has to happen if this Trump revolution ends to some extent. And so public opinion is very crucial. And when you are soft balancing, the effort is also to attract the public's attention and try to see that they change the regime over a period of time. The final question was, the first question was the European foreign policy. Well, Europe offers a lot of good things and some issues. The European idea of consensus, European idea of giving some level of equality to the smaller players, all that are interesting, and whether it is practical or not, and whether it is durable or not, but I think it is a necessary part of European order, and it has its own value, and of course you are debating that in this country in a big way. The point is, what else Europe can do? And there's a lot of people who say, let's get rid of EU, but what else is going to replace that? Traditional balance of power, traditional military power, Germany, France, or whatever, or dominated by these two. Without this institution, by the way, institutions are the best place for smaller states to sit down with the bigger powers and engage them, even if they don't get all their way. And in fact, the biggest supporters of institutions in regional contexts are small states. The SAARC was created by small states, Bangladesh initiated, ASEAN by the smaller states. It was not an American-built institution. APEC, you know, Australia took the initiative. Small states have a big role, interest in creating institutions, maintaining them. They need not succeed all the time, but this is better than they just being takers of great power decisions or big power decisions. So I think the European institutions have to evolve, but it is not yet time to abandon them. I think we need to think of them as... But they haven't played the soft balancing a whole lot, unfortunately or fortunately to some extent, especially with, except with Russia, in the current Ukraine context. And they haven't had a lot of success, partly because, they tend to have a lot of, interest also in maintaining their relationship with Russia. So it's, soft balancing is one of the techniques, and, it requires also collaborators and alliances, and sometimes that is missing for European states.
Thank you very much. Now, before we formally thank you, can I just make two other announcements? There is a talk tomorrow by Professor Philip Murphy, also sponsored by Ideas on the Commonwealth, which is an institution that you didn't mention, but there are countries like India, of course, are very prominent members of that institution. It's called the... Empire's New Clothes, it's perhaps an unfortunate title, thinking about the Commonwealth after Brexit, but you might want to come to that. And next week, on Monday, 21st, Ned LeBeau will be talking about his book, The Rise and Fall of Political Orders. So I think that follows on quite naturally from the talk this evening. There are books out there to be bought and to be signed, so please avail yourself of that opportunity. And lastly, it just remains to thank you. I mean, as George Orwell famously said, when all the other ideologies had been discredited from liberalism to Marxism, pessimism would reign supreme. It's a safe bet to be pessimistic short-term, mid-term, or long-term. You've actually given us a little bit of hope for optimism today, which is extremely unusual. Tomorrow we will hear pessimism. I'm relieved from John Mearsheimer. So thanks very much for coming along.
Thank you. Today.